Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine, it's the AI issue for June 22nd, 2025. One of the articles I will be sharing with you is How AI Sees Us. It might not be smarter than humans, but it can already perceive things about us that we can't. But first, the article titled, Never Say Goodbye. Peter Listro was 83 when he learned he had blood cancer. He was told he had less than a year to live. His wife and son weren't ready to let him go. So they decided to create an AI avatar of Peter to talk to after he dies. This article was written by Susan Dominus. When Matt, Peter Listro's son, grasped that his father's death was imminent, the shock was so strong that it was physical. He felt in his chest the finality of what was to come. Matt, 39, hoped to marry one day. He had always pictured his father beaming at his wedding, and he had loved imagining the kind of grandfather he would be, wry but sage and sympathetic. Matt, eager to ease his sense of loss, persuaded Peter to work with a company called Storyfile to help preserve his memory. The family was taking advantage of one offering in a growing field known as grief tech, which ranges from chatbots trained on the communications of a person who has died to a program that uses virtual reality to create a 3D avatar of a deceased loved one. A remarkably lifelike presence. The Listros decided on something in between. Storyfile would create an avatar of Peter that could converse through a video screen as if his family were reaching him by Zoom. Last month, a producer from Storyfile arrived at the Listros' apartment in New York City to film and interview Peter. The material from that day will become the basis for his avatar. The day of the shoot, Peter sat in an armchair in his living room, one hand crossed over the other. His legs were crossed too, so that his black and white polka dot socks were well exposed. Slight of frame, Peter looked elegant, although to his wife of 30 years, Joan, and to Matt, he appeared almost gaunt. He'd spent 72 days straight in the hospital and lost 18 pounds since he started receiving treatment for his cancer in February. Joan fussed briefly with his belt, which was twisted. "It's a very good belt," Peter said, looking over at Matt. "Make sure you wear it well." Peter smiled. He enjoyed his dark joke about his mortality, but Joan grimaced. "I'm going to kill him," she said. Peter had not agreed to participate in this project because he suddenly felt the call of posterity. He was doing it for Matt and Joan. Maybe it would provide them some comfort after he was gone. First, the producer asked Peter to repeat some stock phrases. "Say hello," she directed Peter. "Say hi." Peter did as he was told. Somehow he sounded as if the word hi had never come out of his mouth before, as if he were already imagining himself as some kind of futuristic robot. He said, as directed, "I don't have an answer for that right now." The response that would be generated if someone asked his AI self a question that he hadn't answered during this interview. He was directed to say, "I love you too," and, "It was nice talking with you." "Bye," he said on command. "Bye for now." One after another, the producer asked Peter questions from a list Matt had provided. "What is your favorite childhood memory? What would you tell your son on the day you meet his husband? What would you say to Matt the day his first child is born? Could you talk about the time that Matt, as a kid, asked why you loved him?" Peter wept as he recalled the moment. "He is the best son," he said. He took a few minutes, wiped his eyes with a tissue, breathed. For some answers, Matt left the room. He wanted to hear them fresh at the appropriate time in his life. Peter spoke about growing up in modest circumstances in Queens, explaining how he built and sold a thriving business that sold baby monitors and other products for parents. Although he was proud of the comfortable life he had provided for his family, some of the memories Peter recalled were clearly painful. He had a sister with severe cognitive disabilities who was institutionalized. As a child, Peter agonized over his sister's isolation, wishing he could do more to help her. "I tried," he said, bowing his head. Peter was speaking for the record, for eternity, weighing the life that he was putting behind him as he also imagined some version of it living on indefinitely. From time to time, Joan asked if he needed a break. "No," he said, "keep going." Some days he was too weak to get out of bed. That day, however, he sat in the chair and answered questions for 5 straight hours, breaking only briefly to eat a piece of a bagel. His mood seemed to improve as the day passed. He was energized, even relieved to be given the opportunity to say what he had to say, to tell Joan that he wanted her to move on, to encourage her to be strong and know that her life would continue without him. She wouldn't just be hearing it, preserved on audio. She'd be making eye contact with him as he said it to her. She would have a sense of his realness. Maybe the message would resonate more that way. Around 4:30 p.m., Joan walked Peter back to his bedroom to rest. He later told her the day had meant more to him than he had anticipated. About a week later, Matt sat down in his apartment in Brooklyn and clicked on a link that StoryFile provided with some preliminary interactive material. There was his father, legs crossed, black and white polka dot socks, the belt that Joan fiddled with on the day of the shoot. Peter became mobile in his seat, ever so slightly. His expression looked slightly apprehensive. If Matt pressed a talk button, his father nodded his head a bit as if to encourage Matt to go on. StoryFile frequently works with foundations and museums, but it has already made interactive videos for several individual clients. In the future, the company intends to release a generative AI app in which customers can create avatars that answer questions not provided in advance by uploading a person's email, social media posts, and other background material. Matt and Joan preferred what they signed up for, which would be an avatar of Peter who answered only the questions that were posed while he was alive. Everything he said they would know was something he believed to be true, rather than an extrapolation. "It won't change the reality that I've lost my father," Matt said, "but it lessens the blow ever so slightly, knowing that when he does die, it won't be the last time I'll ever have a conversation with him." Matt stared into the laptop. "Why do you often say, 'keep moving'?" he asked his father. "I feel it's very, very important that people don't get stuck," Peter responded. "If you want to grow, if you want to get ahead, it's important. And it's something I always tell Matthew, and I would tell this to my grandchildren." Matthew tried another. "What's a memory you cherish about us?" he asked. He was shocked when his father's face on the screen suddenly crumbled. Peter rubbed his head as if to distract himself from the pain. Matt realized that he was capturing his father at a particular moment when they all knew his death was imminent. The emotion on screen reflected the emotion that motivated the shoot in the first place, early grief. Sometimes the audio system didn't register what Matt was asking, or he asked a question that wasn't part of the recording process. "I don't have an answer for that right now," his father said. The rote response to Matt was jarring. It jolted him out of the illusion he was experiencing and brought him to the brink of tears. It was a harsh reminder that he would never, after his father died, be able to ask him anything fresh. They had spent a day asking Peter questions Matt knew he'd want to have answers for. But what about all the questions that would come up that he couldn't now even imagine. Matt felt a tension between being moved by how real the experience felt, yet also being reminded that it was a rendering. Peter was hoarse. He sometimes licked his lips, dehydrated. Matt wanted nothing more than to offer him a glass of water, a longing he knew he'd feel every time he watched. At times, when his father wept, Matt felt an even more powerful impulse to comfort him. Seeing him cry on camera was really difficult, Matt texted me. It was a reminder that this is a human I love that I want to console, but you can't console a video clip. Matt closed the laptop, comforted for the moment by the knowledge that, the next day, he would see his father in real life. Susan Dominus, who wrote this article, has been a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine since 2011. And now here are some of the comments from readers of this article, and these are the reader's picks. The first is from MLM in Rochester, New York. I lost my young husband 20 years ago. Walking home from work, he became the victim of a random homicide. The day after he died, I received the first of many letters that would follow from friends, colleagues, neighbors, and people we barely knew. One of my husband's university students wrote that first letter, which included detailed stories about my sweet husband that I had never heard. Even while experiencing a pain I could never have fathomed, I learned that I would be making new memories with my husband. Each letter felt like a visit with my dear husband. While it is great if AI helps people keep their loved ones close, the simple act of a letter filled with memories can do much the same thing. Even the most trivial memory counts. A neighbor with whom I had never spoken shared how much she enjoyed seeing my husband walk our baby daughter alone, just the two of them. Those letters mean the world to me. They are a witness to the fact that he was here, that he mattered. Love lives on, regardless of what form it takes. From Jeff Cohen in New York. To each his own. My dad died in 2004, and I have hours and hours of him talking and just being his wonderful self. 21 years later, I have never watched them because they just make me sad that he isn't here anymore. Still, pictures are good enough for me. Hearing him talk is just too vivid a reminder of a loss I still feel, but not with the intensity a video would bring. My kids enjoy watching them, though, and have preserved the old tapes digitally and stored them on the cloud, hopefully not far from where Dad hangs out with Mom, JFK, FDR, and other of his heroes. And finally, from the woman on the gray horse in North Carolina. My mother died 2 years ago at 103. She was strong and active to the very end. Though we disagreed often, I talked to her every day for 50 years. I have a dozen or so voice messages from her on my phone and saved as audio files in case my service provider deletes them. It's wonderful to hear her voice. It's Mother. It's a beautiful day here. Call me when you get this. I wish I could. And now our next article, How AI Sees Us. It might not be smarter than humans, but it can already perceive things about us that we can't. This article was written by Charlie Locke. Picture a human face. The eyebrows are furrowed and the eyes wide. The lips are pressed together, turning downward at one corner. When AI sees this face, it evaluates the features using a combination of metrics. How wrinkled the nose is, how squinted the eyes are, whether the jaw is clenched. Then it correlates those features with a range of emotions along with other states, such as confusion and engagement. The conclusion? This expression is associated with anger, sadness, and surprise. Not only can AI now make these assessments with remarkable human-like accuracy, it can make millions of them in an instant. AI's superpower is its ability to recognize and interpret patterns. to sift through raw data and by comparing it across vast data sets to spot trends, relationships, and irregularities. As humans, we constantly generate patterns in the sequence of our genes, the beating of our hearts, the repetitive motion of our muscles and joints. Everything about us, from the cellular level to the way our bodies move through space, is a source of grist for AI to mine. And so it's no surprise that, as the power of the technology has grown, some of its most startling new abilities lie in its perception of us, our physical forms, our behavior, and even our psyches. Consider a small part of the face, the eyes. AI ocular tracking has gotten very good at analyzing tiny involuntary eye movements, such as pupil dilation and blinking. In some cases, it can predict where our gaze is drifting before we even know it ourselves. By noting how our eyes move and comparing that information with thousands of recordings of people driving, AI can help bus and truck manufacturers determine when drivers are, or about to be, distracted. By tracking where we look and how long our gaze lingers, it allows video game developers to fine-tune user experience so minutely that players can aim a weapon using only their eyes. AI has also made lie detection technology more sophisticated. A traditional polygraph measures changes in the subject's body, heart rate, sweating, and blood pressure, as they answer a series of questions. But now an infrared camera can measure pupil dilation and eye movements during questioning, and that information can then be uploaded to a server where AI reads the data and determines a credibility score. This technology has been used to hire United Nations personnel and to question suspects in police investigations. AI is already revolutionizing the way doctors look for patterns inside our own bodies. A radiologist screening for tuberculosis might look at an X-ray and notice, for example, enlarged lymph nodes or fluid around the lungs. Or they might see a tiny nodule about the size of a pencil eraser that could possibly be lung cancer. But AI can look at a grayscale image and detect differences beyond the ability of the naked human eye. It could see the initial shape of a nodule forming and predict whether it was cancerous or benign, or look at a patchy white area in the X-ray and determine whether it was more likely to be associated with tuberculosis or pneumonia. AI can also help screen for cardiovascular disease, which is particularly meaningful for patients whose symptoms, like shortness of breath, are so common that they are often missed by doctors. Developers have trained one AI model to specifically predict those often misdiagnosed cases and recommend certain patients for further care before they leave the hospital or clinic. Blood work is one of our most important forms of bodily data. It's easy to see why this has proved irresistible as a target for healthcare startups. Blood testing is such a rich source of information that even marginal improvements could revolutionize the medical field and save lives. Researchers are training AI to spot patterns in our blood, diagnosing cancer and heart disease. AI can also streamline the process of delivering blood transfusions, predicting supply from blood banks and demand from patients. Our blood keeps an internal log of all the pathogens that have breached our immune defenses, recorded in the form of antibodies and receptors on white blood cells that can recognize those antibodies. One AI model has been trained to find patterns in the DNA of the receptors which indicate responses to specific diseases. With autoimmune diseases like lupus, the immune system attacks itself. Diagnosis can be a lengthy process requiring physical exams, a range of lab tests, and ruling out other possible conditions. But researchers are using AI to sequence the immune system's receptors and figure out which cells protect someone from tetanus or the flu and which are attacking their own body. The goal is to diagnose certain autoimmune diseases more quickly and accurately. Our bodies also generate countless patterns with our physical movement. AI is currently being used to optimize training for athletes to improve prosthetic limbs, to correct movements in physical therapy, and even to analyze many bodies at once. For example, to monitor crowd density and flow during public gatherings. But the most novel and creative use of AI and biomechanics might be in animation. Traditionally, animators had to create a digital skeleton beneath a character's outer layer, then manually set the character's poses. AI can now create incredibly realistic smooth movements that the animator can manipulate quickly and experiment with before committing to a certain pose. With one AI tool, you can move a character's foot and the rest of the body will move accordingly, much like a human's does. The animator acts almost like a choreographer, setting a few poses and allowing the AI to fill in the frames between them. Animators can easily generate different kinds of movement, like walking, running, or jumping. AI also allows an animator to apply physics to character's body, automatically calculating the center of mass, weight distribution, and momentum. For a character doing a backflip, for example, an animator can adjust where the figure lands, which automatically changes the arc of his flip. If an animator wants a character to jump higher, he can tweak the maximum height. The model will automatically adjust how forcefully the character jumps from the ground. The foundational data set in our bodies is the firing of neurons, which creates everything we think and are. Researchers are experimenting with AI to produce sentences from the brains of ALS patients who have lost the ability to speak, to objectively measure how much pain a person is experiencing, and to treat Parkinson's with brain pacemakers. In one fascinating 2024 study that built on earlier research, AI was fed an image of blood flow in the brain that had been generated by functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. When a person looked at an image of a cat, AI was able to read the fMRI data and generate a very realistic image of a similar cat. Visual reconstruction AI still has limitations, but the study's suggestion felt profound. What if this technology could ultimately work as a kind of translator for our brains, recreating detailed memories or dreams, allowing others to see what we see? The patterns generated by our neurons are the ultimate frontier in human self-knowledge, a system so complex that even neuroscientists haven't fully deciphered it. The human brain, like AI, has been compared to a black box. While we can comprehend its inputs and outputs, its exact machinery remains mysterious to us, too intricate and dynamic to map. Will AI, through its phenomenal powers of pattern recognition, be able to shed light on that mystery? If so, regardless of whether the technology ever achieves so-called super intelligence, its great legacy could be what it tells us about our own minds. Charlie Locke, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the magazine. She has recently written about what brings teenagers joy, how they are experiencing climate change, retirement rituals, and memorizing poetry. Well, I finished those two articles much sooner than I had anticipated, so good news is I have time to read another article from this AI issue of the New York Times Magazine. Just want to take a brief moment, though, to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And the next article from, again, the AI issue of the New York Times Magazine is titled AI is poised to rewrite history, literally. The technology's ability to read and summarize text is already making it a useful tool for scholarship. How will it change the stories we tell about the past? This article was written by Bill Wasik. During my 25 years as a magazine editor, my favorite part of the job has always been helping writers figure out what the story is, where to start it, where to end it, what's important and new about it. So it was with no small amount of humility that earlier this year, I sat in a Google corporate cafeteria along the west side of Manhattan and watched as one of my longtime writers, Stephen Johnson, the technology journalist and historian, received that kind of guidance from an AI instead of me. Johnson, who has published popular histories about pirate attacks, the invention of modern policing, and the birth of public health, had begun noodling on a possible book about the California gold rush of the mid-19th century, he explained, but he was still at the point where he didn't know much more than that. "What's my twist?" he said. "Literally, I don't know." To figure it out, Johnson had loaded some of his sources into Notebook LM, an app for researchers and writers that he himself helped build after becoming the editorial director of Google's Labs division 3 years ago. Unlike most other AI tools which draw their answers to questions from the mind-boggling infinitude of data they were trained on, Notebook LM draws only from files selected by the user, on the premise that most forms of research benefit from thoughtfully curating your source material. Since the product's worldwide release last year, Google and Johnson have been promoting its utility for all manner of tasks, whether it's auto-generating minutes and takeaways from an audio recording of a meeting, or encouraging a more licit use of AI among college students. Noting LM's most viral capability is an auto-generated podcast, which in a matter of a couple of minutes will spit out a detailed conversation between two freakishly realistic voices, drawing out the key concepts of the source material. But as an occasional author of history books myself, I was most interested in how AI, one of whose many superpowers is the ability to inhale large amounts of text in an instant and offer credible summaries of it, might transform the way history is written. At Google that evening, as the sun went down over the Hudson, Johnson showed me the results of his experiments so far. He started his brainstorming process by giving Notebook LM excerpts from one of the finest existing histories on the gold rush, H.W. Brandeis's The Age of Gold. He thought he might want to focus on the conflict between white gold seekers and the Native American groups living in the Yosemite Valley in the 1850s, so he uploaded the text of an older source called Discovery of the Yosemite by Lafayette Houghton Bunnell, who was part of the Mariposa Battalion, the militia unit that rode into the valley in 1851. Next, to bring in the indigenous perspective, he went to public domain websites and found two accounts about the people whom the battalion expelled from the valley, the Awanichis, a story of the Yosemite Indians, and Indians of the Yosemite Valley and vicinity. Johnson started his conversation with Notebook LM with a little orientation, identifying himself as the author Stephen Johnson, so that the AI, whose training allows it to understand almost the whole internet, as ChatGPT does, even if constrains its answers to the uploaded sources, might get a sense for the kinds of books he writes. Then he started peppering it with questions. What in the two sources that focused on the indigenous experience, he asked, was missing from the other two sources? When the model returned its summary, his eye was caught by the observation that the Awanichis, by including short biographies of individual Yosemite Indians, helps to humanize the people beyond being a tribal mass, which is something that The Age of Gold, and Bunnell's book tend to do. The AI listed some of their names, among them Maria Librado, granddaughter of the Yosemite chief Tenaya. That piqued Johnson's interest. He asked for more information about Librado, and the tool returned nearly 600 words of biography, that she was one of the 72 native people forced to leave the valley by the battalion in March 1851, that she eventually married a Mexican man who ran a pack train down in the Central Valley, that she was discovered by a white historian in the 1920s and held up as the last of the original Yosemite Indians. Right away, Johnson recognized that she would make a great character. He took note in particular of the fact that Librado returned to the valley near the end of her life. "I'm like, what's the expletive structure of Titanic?" he joked. The book could open with what Johnson imagined was Librado's emotional return to the valley at nearly 90 years old, before zooming back in time, to her childhood, to a broader cast of characters and the violent drama of the 1850s. Johnson wasn't sold on this idea yet, but he marveled at how AI operating with mostly open-source texts and a tiny amount of human labor had delivered him a concept that he absolutely could use. "Everything I've just showed you is like 30 minutes of work," he said. "Like most people who work with words for a living, I've watched the rise of large language models with a combination of fascination and horror, and it makes my skin crawl to imagine one of them writing on my behalf. But there is, I confess, something seductive about the idea of letting AI read for me, considering how cruelly the internet era explosion of digitized text now mocks nonfiction writers with access to more voluminous sources on any given subject than we can possibly process. This is true not just of present-day subjects, but past ones as well. Any history buff knows that a few hours of searching online, amid the tens of millions of books digitized by Google, the endless trove of academic papers available on JSTOR, the newspaper databases that let you keyword search hundreds of publications on any given day in history, can cough up months or even years' worth of reading material. It's impossible to read it all, but once you know it exists, it feels irresponsible not to read it. What if you could entrust most of that reading to someone else, or something else? As AI becomes more capable of parsing large data sets, it seems inevitable that historians and other nonfiction writers will turn to it for assistance. In fact, as I discovered in surveying a wide variety of historians over the last few months, experiments with it are already far more common than I expected. But it also seems inevitable that this power to help search and synthesize historical texts will change the kinds of history books that are written. If history, per the adage, is written by the winners, then it's not premature to wonder how the winners of the AI race might soon shape the stories that historians tell about the past. Among the historians I spoke with, one of the more enthusiastic experimenters was Fred Turner, who teaches in the communication department at Stanford. I arrived at his office expecting to interview him about how AI fits into the long history of information technology, but we wound up spending much of our time discussing how ChatGPT has helped him with his latest book project, which revolves around the New York City art scene of the 1970s and the 1980s. He was at a stage that he called a source outline, meaning a document of 100 pages or so compiling all his research, organized more or less in the arc of the book that I think it's going to become. From that, he was planning to write a proposal, but he figured he would ask ChatGPT first. In response, the chat box rattled off a plausible, polished 8-chapter structure, one that surfaced useful connections in his research and also suggested a more streamlined narrative for the project. Beyond that, he said, what it did was give me my quite scholarly work read back to me through a middlebrow voice. It found the sort of average of my work, which was really interesting. He went on, it was almost as though I got to take the book to market and stand in the bookstore and hold it up in front of a whole bunch of interested but non-specialist readers and have them tell me what was working for them and what wasn't. There are a handful of scholars who are beginning to more formally incorporate the use of LLMs into their work. One of them is Mark Humphreys, a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario, whose research projects involve enormous stores of digitized records from Canadian history. In one project, he and his students used AI to analyze tens of thousands of handwritten records about late 18th and early 19th century fur trading in order to better understand the far-flung community of traders, now known collectively as voyagers, who, with their families, explored and later settled much of what would eventually become Canada. If you can pass those records to a large language model and you can say, tell me who Alexander Henry's trading partners were, Humphreys said, the neat thing is that it's able to very quickly go through and not just search by name, but do cross-referencing, where you're able to find relationships. The goal is to find not just one-to-one transactions between specific voyagers, but chains of interconnection that would be hard for human researchers to make quickly. It takes an AI 20 seconds, Humphreys said. It might take a graduate student doing the same work weeks. To be sure, Humphreys, like Stephen Johnson, is swimming in the deep end of AI experimentation. Most historians I contacted were only dipping a wary toe in the water. When I reached out to Ada Ferrer, Princeton professor and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Cuba, An American History, she wrote back an hour later to say that she had just tried playing with AI in recent weeks. I was finishing up a book and feeling stuck on a title, so I asked ChatGPT, she wrote. I kept tinkering with my prompt, including different themes, making suggestions about tone and so on. In the end, it probably gave me about 20 title ideas. None were quite good enough, however, and her book remained untitled. Ferrer sounded a note that many other academic historians did, that their attitudes toward AI lived in the shadow of their students cheating with it, which simultaneously made them reluctant to touch it, but also seemed to have made them understand just how powerful it was as a tool. I am haunted by the fact that it would be hypocritical for me to use AI given how concerned I am with my students' use of it, said Jefferson Cowie of Vanderbilt, who won a Pulitzer Prize in 2023 for his book, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. But, he added, I also know that a few people will be putting it to astoundingly creative use once we get a handle on it. The obvious question hanging over the future of AI history and the technology's utility for all manner of other things comes down to the strides it needs to make on its accuracy problem. Charles C. Mann, author of 1491 and most recently The Wizard and the Prophet, told me that he experimented with various models while researching a new book project about the history of the American West, and they turned up some great leads, but he became disturbed at how easy it was for them to regurgitate bad information. Mann contrasted it with the rigor of a human editorial process. I'm sure you've had that moment as a journalist, where a smart editor has said, "Wait a second, does this make sense?" And you say, oh crap, it doesn't. That's what AI can't do. It has no bullshit detector. In May of this year, The Times published bracing numbers about how, inexplicably for all the strides and capability that LLMs were otherwise making, their hallucination problem was getting worse. For example, on a benchmark test, OpenAI's new O3 reasoning model delivered inaccuracies 33% of the time, more than twice the rate of its predecessor. To Johnson and his team at Google, the persistence of this problem validates the approach of Notebook LM. While the tool does occasionally misrepresent what's in its sources and passes along errors from those sources without much ability to fact-check them, constraining the research material does seem to cut down on the types of whole cloth fabrications that still emerge from the major chatbots. That said, Johnson also believes that the most exciting uses for LLMs in nonfiction research are the ones in which the results will always be fact-checked. Rather than seeing AI as an undergrad research assistant, he's envisioning it as more like a colleague from another department, or perhaps a smart book agent or editor who can help him see the most interesting version of his own ideas. It should be noted that, for other historians, this is hardly an inspiring prospect. When I asked Stacy Schiff, the author of decorated biographies of Cleopatra and Vera Nabokov, about the notion of consulting AI on how to structure a piece of writing, she replied, "To turn to AI for structure seems less like a cheat than a deprivation, like enlisting someone to eat your hot fudge sundae for you." How might AI change the way history is written and understood? To answer that question, it's useful to think about LLMs as merely the latest in a long series of shifts in the organizing of human knowledge. At least since the 3rd century BC, when Callimachus wrote his Poenox, a series of books, now lost, cataloging the holdings of the famous library, now lost, in Alexandria, humanity has devised increasingly sophisticated systems for navigating pools of information too large for any one individual to take in. Such systems inevitably have a double edge when it comes to scholarly research, a task where efficiency always risks being synonymous with cutting corners. The printed index in books, a device dating back at least to the year 1467, allowed scholars to find relevant material without reading each tome in full. From the perspective of human knowledge, was that a step toward utopia or dystopia? Even now, 558 years later, who's to say? Innovations that cultivate serendipity, such as the Dewey Decimal System, by whose graces a trip into the stacks for one book often leads to a different, more salient discovery, must also, by definition, be plagued by arbitrariness. Classify a book about the Mariposa Battalion with Brands's The Age of Gold and other Gold Rush titles, 979.404, and it will acquire a very different set of neighbors than if it's classified as a book about the battalion's victims, native populations, multiple tribes, 973.0497. The rise of computers and the internet were, of course, an unprecedented turning point in the history of tools for writing history, exponentially increasing the quantity of information about the past and, at the same time, our power to sift and search that information. Psychologically, digital texts and tools have thrown us into an era, above all, of availability. Both in the colloquial sense of that word, everything's seemingly available, and in the social scientific sense of availability bias, whereby we can fool ourselves into thinking that we have a clear and complete picture of a topic, buffaloed by the sheer quantity of supporting facts that can spring up with a single motivated search. Even among academic historians, this availability has shifted incentives in a direction that AI is likely to push even further. In 2016, years before the LLM explosion, the University of Pittsburgh historian Laura Putnam published an essay about the achievements, but also the dangers of search-driven digital research. For the first time, historians can find without knowing where to look, she wrote in a particularly trenchant paragraph. Technology has exploded the scope and speed of discovery, but our ability to read accurately the sources we find and evaluate their significance cannot magically accelerate space. The more far-flung the locales linked through our discoveries, the less consistent our contextual knowledge. The place-specific learning that historical research in a pre-digital world required is no longer baked into the process. We make rookie mistakes. Putnam's essay wasn't a jeremiad against digital tools, which can power what she memorably calls the sideways glance, the ability for a historian whose expertise lies squarely in one domain to get up to speed more quickly on other topics. Digital search has allowed historians to make genuine, powerful connections that wouldn't have been made otherwise. But she worried about what was being lost, especially given that the pool of digitized sources, even as it keeps growing, remains stubbornly unrepresentative, biased toward the English language and toward wealthy nations over poor ones, but biased especially toward official sources, those printed rather than written, housed in institutional rather than smaller or less formal archives. Gazing at the past through the lens of the digitizable, Putnam notes, makes certain phenomena prominent and others less so, renders certain people vividly visible and others vanishingly less so. When she and I chatted recently, Putnam compared this shift to Baumol's cost disease, the phenomenon noted by the economist William Baumol, that when technology makes certain workers more efficient, it winds up making other forms of labor more expensive and therefore harder to justify. In principle, Putnam notes, digital tools have no downside. Professional historians remain more than capable of carrying out time-consuming research in physical archives. But in practice, the different, faster, more connective kind of research was making the more traditional work seem too professionally expensive by comparison. Why spend a month camped out in some dusty repository, not knowing for sure that anything publishable will even turn up, when instead you can follow real, powerful intellectual trails through the seeming infinitude of sources accessible from the comfort of home? Putnam hasn't experimented with AI research herself, and her own fears run to the basic, and perhaps correct, nightmare scenario that the technology will destroy the history business the same way that it's destroying the art of student essay writing, i.e., by composing texts that are just plausible enough to make human work irrelevant. But even if that nightmare is averted and AI becomes the human historian's collaborator instead of her replacement, it's easy to see how AI summarization could transform nonfiction writing along lines analogous to what digital search has done. The individual sources would fade yet further into the background as users trust tools like Notebook LM to offer cogent-seeming summaries of enormous troves of texts without much attention to their origins or agendas. What becomes staggeringly cheap in such a world is work that attempts to synthesize astonishing amounts of material, perhaps drawing on sources far beyond what a single human could process in a lifetime, ranging promiscuously across languages, borders, and time periods at a speed that would allow a single human to complete multiple such projects in a career. The potential upsides of such a shift should not be discounted. At the moment, perhaps the greatest drama in the world of popular history is the question of whether the 89-year-old Robert Caro can finish the fifth and final volume of his Lyndon Johnson biography, a titanic undertaking that has consumed 50 years of his life. His personal papers, some of which he has already given to the New York Historical, so far constitute 150 linear feet of file boxes, and one wonders how many more prodigious biographies Caro could have produced over those 50 years if a chatbot had been able to synthesize some portion of that material for him. Then again, without a mania to touch every single source himself, and to pour the rigor of all that relentless reading into his prose, an AI-assisted Robert Caro would not have been Robert Caro at all. In Stephen Johnson's experiments with Gold Rush history, the most eye-opening result came when he floated a structural thought of his own to the Notebook LM chatbot. It drew on Johnson's infatuation with what he calls the long zoom, a mode of storytelling that, like the famous Charles and Ray Eames documentary, Powers of Ten, moves exponentially in time or scale. "Just thought of a cool structure for this book," he told the chatbot. "Maybe most of it is a series of chapters telling the story leading up to the Mariposa Battalion events, meaning the invasion of Yosemite Valley. But each chapter is a time scale. So chapter one is called A Million Years Before, chapter two is 1,000 years before, chapter three is 100 years before, etc., etc. A decade, a year, a month, a week, a day. And then the war starts in 1851, and then there's a long epilogue. Sketch out what the content of each of those chapters could be. What part of the big picture story would we be telling in that segment?" Johnson already knew why that structure could work, because the time scales that endowed the valley with the key elements of the drama, gold, the first humans, the specific indigenous nations of the mid-19th century, the encroaching white settlers, stretching out over all those powers of ten. But it was astonishing to see that the AI perceived all of that, too, without Johnson having to tell it. A million years before, the geological formation of the Sierra Nevada, the creation of the gold deposits and the carving of the Yosemite Valley by glacial activity. 1,000 years before, early human migrations and the establishment of indigenous cultures in the Sierra Nevada, focusing on their adaptation to the environment. 100 years before, the lives of the ancestors of the Yosemite Indians, intertribal relationships, early contact with Europeans and the initial impacts of disease. A decade before, the increasing American presence in California, the Mexican-American War, the annexation of California, and the initial rumors of gold. A year before, the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill, the rapid influx of prospectors, the establishment of mining camps and the first signs of conflict with Native American tribes, introduction of key figures like James Savage and Chief Tenya. A month before, escalating tensions, raids on trading posts, the formation of settler militias, and failed attempts at negotiation leading to the Mariposa War. A week before, the organization and movements of the Mariposa Battalion, the perspectives of the Yosemite Indians as conflict becomes imminent. A day before, the final hours before the outbreak of the Mariposa War, focusing on the psychological states and expectations of individuals on both sides. Earlier this spring, I went to visit Johnson at Google's campus in Mountain View, California, for an update on his progress. Johnson had stuck with his cosmic powers of ten approach, and he now was trying to refine his concept for a first chapter, the one set a million years before 1851. He told me that he had become obsessed with the California oak, whose acorns were one of the main sources of subsistence that allowed the earliest indigenous groups to settle in the valley. When I sat down with Johnson in a conference room, he showed me Notebook LM's new Mind Map feature, which creates an auto-generated conceptual tree from your source material, allowing you to explore thematically without having to write specific queries. He was interested in a phenomenon called masting, in which oaks sync up to drop large quantities of acorns in a single season, and he had added a group of sources on masting into the tool. Then he generated a mind map for them, which created forking thematic paths about the phenomenon. For example, the topic hypotheses for masting branched out to include predator satiation hypothesis, pollination efficiency hypothesis, and more. Johnson saw the utility of all this in similar terms to how Putnam talked about the sideways glance. I don't need to be an expert on acorns, but I do want to have two paragraphs about acorns. Here at the Mountain View mothership, it was easier to understand Notebook LM as just one of a host of AI tools that the tech giant was developing, all swirling around the theme of creativity. In just a couple of months, the company's DeepMind division would introduce VEO3, which can create high-definition videos with realistic audio entirely from prompts written by users. Flow, a different video project within Google Labs, was helping teams of up-and-coming filmmakers create AI elements for their projects, giving them access to, say, a caliber of animation or exotic settings from around the world that they couldn't have afforded otherwise. Johnson and I were joined by Josh Woodward, the head of Google Labs, who told me that he saw AI as capable of aiding creative projects in two ways. First, it can lower the barrier, helping people undertake projects that they otherwise couldn't, whether out of a lack of resources, lack of training, or both. And second, it can raise the ceiling, helping established creators take their projects to new levels. In terms of raising the ceiling, the division was working with Hollywood talent, you would know their names, to use AI on particular shots in major films. Of course, there's an economic dimension to it, Woodward said, but these established creators were also seeing how the technology let them explore so many more stories so fast. These tools, along with those being developed elsewhere in Silicon Valley, clearly have the capacity to throw the creative economy into even greater turmoil. Beyond that, many of them, the mind-boggling video generation engines in particular, seem likely to accelerate the cultural changes that have made serious writing less and less relevant in the internet era. Perhaps it was naive to even worry about AIs competing with historians when the typical user, amid a life of increasingly consumed with other nonverbal diversions, is satisfied to receive facts on demand in bite-sized bursts. Alas, I am just a few paragraphs away from completing this article, but I do not have time, so I do apologize. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.